Nuketown Radioactive number 80 for Saturday, August 15th, 2009. On this episode of Nuketown Radioactive, I'm living the geek bachelor life for 2 weeks while my family is away, and thus, you get a new podcast. I recount my trip to Origins 2009, geek out about our new Blue Dolphin netbook, and give a progress report on my summer reading list. Welcome to Nuketown Radioactive. I am your host, Ken Newquist, and this is the occasional, some might say rare, others might say downright infrequent, podcast about life, liberty, and the pursuit of geekdom. And wow, I think it's been about 6 weeks since the last podcast, and a lot has been going on since then. I reviewed a boatload of games for Sci-Fi Wire. I'm not going to be running those down in this particular episode because I have a lot of other stuff to talk about. I went on vacation. I went to Origins Game Fair in Columbus, Ohio. I read a boatload of books. I went camping more times than I think I've been camping in the last 5 years. And, well, what can I say? I've just been having a really good summer. So, unfortunately, the downside to that, of course, is that you guys don't get podcasts. But you're getting a podcast now, and I'll tell you the reason why. It is because I am temporarily a geek bachelor dad for the next 2 weeks. My family has decamped from Easton, Pennsylvania, and gone up north with some family friends of ours and their kids to hang out on Lake Champlain and basically rough it for 2 weeks. They're not camping. This is actually the place where we went to back in July, actually, as a whole family. It's a cabin. Friends of ours got a cabin up, I guess, last year, and they invited us to come. So back in June, I went, and that's one of the reasons why you guys didn't get any podcasts, because there's no power. There's no electricity. I guess that's another word for power, isn't it? there's no internet, is what I meant to say. And, you know, there's really not a lot of opportunities to bring your computer along, at least not a MacBook Pro, and we'll get into that in a little bit. So, in any case, it was awesome back in June when I got to go, because I got to hang out and play with the kids and read a book and generally just kind of relax away from technology for a while. However, August is not a great time for me to go on vacation, and as much as I would love to go back up to Lake Champlain again, going there now would probably cause my coworkers to hunt me down and drag me back to campus, because this is about the busiest time of year you can have for someone who works in IT at a college. Everything is coming together right now. We've got the fall semester looming large, and I have a crazy amount of work to do. But the plus side to not seeing my family for 2 weeks is that I have time to, you know, take a little break and record a podcast. Now, I will say, on the whole vacation thing, this is the longest I've been away from my kids for, well, since they were born. I think this is actually the longest I've ever been away from Sue. We've gone like 10 days. I think Sue went on an extended camping trip for 10 days a couple of years ago. But in the 13 years we've been together, we've just never been apart for this long. And wow, I don't know. I may be talking to myself, or you guys, or the dog, or whatever, a lot more at the end of those 2 weeks. So if you see me starting to act a little weird, well, maybe that's it. In any case, my big geeky thing that I did this summer was go to Origins 2009, and whoa, it was just really cool. A whole bunch of friends from my gaming group went to Origins, and I guess there were five of us all told, and I got to meet a bunch of really just awesome people at Origins. I got to game with Mer Lafferty, David Moore from the Game Masters Show, a whole bunch of friends whom I get to talk to and, you know, tweet with and whatever online, you know, for years on end, but you never actually get to see face to face. This was my opportunity to actually see them and game. We got to play Spirit of the Century. We got to play Arkham Horror. And it was just, it was an awesome experience, and I guess can't get over it. Now that I start thinking about it, I just have to start geeking out all over again because it was really cool. It was definitely worth the money, the time, the energy, and the eventual exhaustion from gaming nonstop for 4 days. But I also brought home a bunch of really cool stuff from Origins. In fact, I'm still reading it. I've barely made my way through about half of it. But here's what I picked up at Origins. I got Hackmaster Basic, which is Kenzer Company's new and improved version of Hackmaster. Basically, the original version of Hackmaster was based on first edition D&D with some Hackmaster-ish stuff layered on top of it. Really crunchy rules like, critical hits and critical fumbles and, pages about how to roll your dice and DMing advice and all that kind of spun from a Hackmaster humor kind of angle. And I think a lot of people thought of it as a joke RPG, but then it turns out that, hey, this is actually a game that people wanted to play. It was very obviously old school since it was first edition D&D. The problem is that Wizards pulled the license along when they pulled a bunch of the other licenses as they were coming out with D&D 4th edition. So Kenzer had to decide what to do. And what they decided to do was released a new version of Backmaster that is been rebuilt from the ground up. There's a lot here that looks familiar. You have kind of your standard stats that you would have in D&D with a couple of other attributes thrown in. You have your familiar classes, your familiar races, and all this. I've got a write-up on Hackmaster on Nuketown, so I'll include a link to in the show notes. I don't want to recount the whole thing here, but basically it's just a really crunchy old school game. And despite that, it runs pretty quick. I actually got a chance to play it at Origins as well, and I liked what I saw. I really want to try it again at home with my friends and see how it shakes out, but so far I think it's a pretty good little system. I picked up two supplements for Savage Worlds. The first one is the Savage Worlds Fantasy Companion, which is basically a repackaged version of the Fantasy Toolkit, which is a series of PDFs that were published giving you supplemental rules if you wanted to run a fantasy game using Savage Worlds. It's what I've really been waiting for. I like the PDFs, but the thing is that I really just would rather have them as a print product. This one matches the form factor of the Savage Worlds Explorers Edition, so it's a small little folio. It's about the same size. It costs $20, but it was great. It has a couple of additional races. It has a whole bunch of magic items. It has additional powers. And I'm trying to think, monsters, just everything you would really need to run kind of a classic Dungeons and Dragons sword and sorcery kind of game. I think it would tend a little bit more towards, your Conan-esque, pulpy kind of RPG than maybe like a high fantasy thing like the Forgotten Realms. But I think you could run a really good game with this. And I gotta say, I was pretty impressed by the little book. I don't know if I'll have a chance to run it anytime soon, but I'm looking forward to them coming out with science fiction and pulp versions of these because I'll buy them up just so I can have them when I finally get a chance to run the game. Now, the other thing that I picked up was the campaign setting, The Day After Ragnarok, which is Ken Hite has really outdone himself here. The Day After Ragnarok is about what would have happened if the Nazis had woken the Midgard World Serpent. And what if America killed it with an atomic bomb? Now, imagine, the huge World Serpent, right, wrapping its coils around the planet, and it awakens, and this gigantic head that's, 100 miles in diameter rears up into the stratosphere, and here comes an American bomber with an atomic bomb on board, and they fly it right into the serpent's eye. And they kill it. And here's the thing, you've just materialized this immense serpent, which then falls to Earth because you killed it, which causes a huge tidal wave drowning the East Coast of the United States, burying a good chunk of the Middle East and Europe underneath the coils of said serpent, transforming the environment of that entire region and, saving the Japanese from destruction at the hands of the United States, giving rise to sort of a resurrected British Empire, which relocates to Australia and counts South America, or sorry, South Africa and India amongst its holdings. And, it's just a really, really, really cool setting. It's basically like Conan meets 1970s post-apocalyptic Cold War pulp. If any of those things get you excited, you really got to pick up this book. I'm going to be doing a review of it on Nuketown probably in the next week or so. And man, it was just pure pleasure to pick up this book and read through it. It was very exciting, and I'm definitely going to run a one-shot at some point. I don't know when, but I have to run a one-shot of this game. Now, the next thing I picked up was Six Shooters and Spaceships for the Serenity RPG. It's unlikely that I'm going to run Serenity anytime soon. I'm hoping to get in a game at a convention at some point, but the cool thing about this source book is that it has a bunch of Starship maps that I can easily use for my Star Wars campaign, which I run every Friday. So that was just, you know, I saw it on the bookshelf and I thought, oh, this could be handy, and I pick it up and start flipping through it and go, yes, this is perfect. It's got the background, it's got the ship maps, it has a bunch of extra equipment as well for the Serenity game, which would be cool if I get a chance to run it, but the real value for me is the maps and the ship descriptions. Now, while we were at Origins, we came across a whole bunch of really cool Starship minis. It was one of the things that my friend Corey and I went into the con looking for, because we do a fair amount of Starship combat in our Star Wars campaign, and we've been using the WotC Starship miniatures from a while back, but they never released any additional sets for that, and, you know, I mean, it gets kind of boring to be using the same ships over and over again. And the other thing is that we have some kind of... We have a number of ships in the campaign that are kind of iconic. We have the Infinite Regress, which is the ship that belongs to our heroes. We have the Dead Star, which is kind of this pirate slash salvage ship that they've run into a couple of times. And we kind of wanted to have these iconic ships. You know, we wanted miniatures that represent these ships. So you can pull out the Dead Star and go, oh, whoa, now we're in trouble. So Corey and I went to Origins, and our goal was to walk the exhibit hall looking for ships, and man, we found some really, really awesome ships. Now, I think I'll dedicate a podcast hopefully later this summer or maybe in September talking about some of those minis and some of the companies we bought them from, but man, it was pretty cool. We spent probably too much money on that. I think between the two of us, we probably spent like $75 on metal minis, but it was well worth it. Now, the next thing I bought is, well, I mean, it was really popular with my daughter. Wasn't so popular with the adults I've played it with so far, but it's a card game called Flux. And the idea behind Flux is that you start off with a base rule, which is everybody draws one card and then plays one card. And then as you build your hand, you get additional cards that modify the rules. So for example, one of the rules might be draw two cards, and then you have to play one. It might be play four cards, in which case, you know, if you're drawing two but playing four, you're going to quickly run out of cards in your hand. There's some that's like, you know, the person left to the left of you randomly plays one of the cards from your hand. The goal of the game is to complete what are called keepers, or rather to achieve goals. So you have a goal card like squishy chocolate. In order to get squishy chocolate, you have to play what are called keepers. And these keepers are a bunch of like little, what do you call them, symbols. So one of them would be the sun. One of them might be chocolate. And in order to get squishy chocolate, you have to play the sun and chocolate. My daughter absolutely loves this game. I think it is at almost exactly her level. I know a lot of grown-ups enjoy this game. I know a lot of geeks enjoy this game. But for my six-year-old, she just loves this. I think part of it is because she can read a lot of what's on the cards. I think the keepers are really attractive to her. She loves the combinations like, I think playing fetch, in which you need the dog and a stick, or mouse in the house. You need the mouse and the house. Death and Taxes, in which case you need these what are normally negative cards, which are called creepers. Normally, if you have a creeper, you can't win the game, but there are some goals that require you to have them, and you can only win if you have those creepers. So Death and Taxes, you need to have the creepers of death and taxes. What can I say? Jordy and I have had a lot of fun with it. Sue's joined us a couple of times. I haven't had a chance to play with the guys in my gaming group yet. I'm really interested to see what they think of it, to kind of take you know, more of a hardcore gamer approach, right? And see what hardcore gamers think about it. But in any case, it is a pretty casual game. It's easy enough to pick up. I think the challenge with it is probably trying to identify the strategy. Just because you have a card in your hand, you don't want to play that card. You know, those kinds of things. And, you know, once you've played it a couple of times, you kind of get a feel for exactly what the best strategies are. So that was definitely a worthwhile purchase, even if Jordy and I are the only ones who ever play this particular game. The one thing that's really unusual for me is that I didn't buy any dice at Origins, which, normally if I go to a con, I gotta buy dice. It's just kind of a standard thing. But I just really didn't find any dice that particularly thrilled me. And to be honest, my Cthulhu dice from Q Workshop have been rolling great ever since I got them, I guess, in Origins in 2007. You know, so I'm pretty comfortable with the dice I have. I don't feel a real compulsion to buy new ones. You know, I don't want to accidentally lose my luck, right? Because that 20-sided die for the Cthulhu set, it rolls really, really well. But in any case, I just really didn't see any dice that kind of thrilled me. I thought about picking up some pink dice for Jordan, but you know, I kind of feel like she needs to be there to get her dice. I want her to be able to pick out her first set of dice, you know? Now, one of the things that this trip to Columbus, as well as our trip to Butler Island taught us, or at least taught me, is that it is really, really hard to blog on an iPod Touch. I brought the iPod Touch along so that I could update Nuketown, and it was really just kind of an experiment. I had like a blogging app on the iPod Touch, and I wanted to see, you know, could you conceivably do it? And the answer is yes, but it is a colossal, colossal pain in the butt. It is really, really hard to type on, especially, I mean, it's gotten better since the new version of the software came out that makes the keyboard a little bit bigger when you turn it on its side. But, oh my God, you cannot write a full-length blog post using the touch, or at least not easily. So, when I got back from Origins, and while we were on the island, I was talking to my wife about the idea of getting a netbook. You know, a small little computer, maybe about with a 10-inch monitor, running Windows XP as kind of like our vacation computer or our carrying around the house computer. Sue has got this Titanic Vio laptop from Sony, which is just gigantic. The thing sounds like a hovercraft when it's on. And it has no battery life, so you can't actually carry it around the house. And my MacBook Pro, which is a great computer, you know, it's not the kind of thing you want to take to a game convention, right? Because if nothing else, it's really, really, really heavy. I tried this at Origin, actually at Gen Con 2007, and you know, it was killing my back to carry the laptop, the power cord, and all the books that I either needed for a game or I bought while I was at the show. So my thought was, hey, why don't we get this netbook? It could solve a whole bunch of little problems, right? Because now Sue can use this when she needs to run around the house chasing the kids. You know, if she wants to be outside, she can take the netbook. If she wants to be on the third floor, you know, boom, we're good. So I pitched my little idea and Sue went with it, which was just really cool. So we got an Asus, actually, I think it's Asus EPC. It's a 10.1-inch blue netbook, and it's a pretty cool little machine. It's got like a 6.5-hour battery. It's got an Atom processor. I think it's an Atom processor. And, you know, it's not going to win any speed contest, but that's not the point of this machine. It has a mostly full-size keyboard. I think it's like a 75% keyboard, which basically means that it's big enough that I can type on without mishitting keys. I've done some light blogging on it since we got it, and I gotta say, it's perfect. It's exactly what I wanted. It's light enough to be able to take to a game show or take to the island, which is exactly what Sue just did. And I think it's gonna fit in pretty well around here. Now, I will say that we have had some issues with it. Although it's a cool little machine, the charger that came with it, it's not working all that great. It has to be seated just so in order to actually charge the netbook. And just before Sue was about to leave on vacation, the thing just stopped charging entirely. Fortunately, I was able to unplug it, let it sit for about an hour, and then plug it back in again, and lo and behold, it worked. I got this suggestion from a couple of different fan websites for Asus, but oh man, you know, minor heart attacks. So I've already called them about getting a replacement charger, and they're gonna send it when Sue gets back from the island. But you know, it's frustrating whenever you get a new piece of technology and it's really cool, but it doesn't quite work out of the box. It's even worse when you actually have to send parts of it back, right? So all in all, I'm pleased with it. It cost, I think, in the neighborhood of like $320, which was really cheap for you know, to get a computer. So on that point, I can say that it's a good computer. I'd like to see how they do with, you know, fixing this particular problem we're having. I guess I will cautiously recommend it if you're interested in a netbook. A lot of my friends are getting these computers, and for the most part, they've worked really good for them. I seem to be the first one who's really having an issue with it.
I'm sorry, sir. We're about to close for lunch. Lunch be damned. I'm looking for an important book whose very teachings will rend the veils between the worlds and bring forth great Cthulhu himself.
We have many books, sir. Also charms, sigils, filters, phylacteries and educational films, giant pandas...
A special and particular book. I seek the Unaussprechlichen Kulten of Wilhelm von Junz.
Goblin Press or Folio Edition?
Goblin Press.
Sorry, we don't have that, sir.
Folio Edition, then.
I'm sorry, we don't have that either, sir.
Very well. How about the Cathat Aquadingen?
Just sold the last one today, sir.
Damn. What about De Vermis Mistress?
It's on back order, sir.
The Altdown Shards?
I'm sorry.
Revelations of Glarkey?
9 or 12 volume edition.
Both? Any?
No, I'm afraid not, sir.
The Necronomicon?
It's awaiting reprint in paperback.
Well, what do you have then?
Well, if you just care to walk through here into this dimly lit back room, sir, I'm sure you'll find something of interest.
Righty-ho. My lord, that's disgusting. No, stay away from me. Get off! No!
Oh well, I did warn him it was lunchtime.
Lovecraftiana, the little shop of cosmic horrors from Yogg-Sothoth. www.lovecraftiana.com.
So, in the last edition of Nuketown Radioactive, I ran down my summer reading list and I thought I'd update y'all on my progress. I'm doing pretty good. I am, let's see, 4 books down, which is, I think, pretty good. I mean, I've really hit my goal for the summer. Any other books I get in are just gravy. Okay, so what did I read? Redemption Arc by Alistair Reynolds. It took way too long to get started and to get back to the characters from Revelation Space, which this is a sequel to. But ultimately, it was a good, hard science fiction / space opera mix with some really, really just huge space structures. You know, the gigantic alien... war machine type thing. It was cool stuff. I really enjoyed it. I'm looking forward to picking up the next book. The next thing I read was The Dreaming Void by Peter F. Hamilton, which was another book that really took its time getting started. The premise is a little shaky. There's a pocket universe at the center of the galaxy, which is a medieval world with telepathic and telekinetic powers, or rather the people on this world have telekinetic and telepathic powers. This pocket universe sends dreams to the galaxies at large that have attracted a huge following, and these living dream adherents want to enter the void. The downside to this is that the rest of the galaxy fears that this will cause the pocket universe to expand, consuming part or all of the galaxy. It wasn't bad, and I really enjoyed the tie-ins to Hamilton's earlier Pandora's Star and Judas Unleashed books, but I wish there was more out-and-out space opera, and, well, less sex. A few big starship battles would have been nice, and this tome is certainly setting up for some of those, but I suspect that I'll have to wait for The Temporal Void, which is this book's sequel, in order to get to those. I'll read part 2, but the book's definitely a step down from Pandora's Star. Now, talking about space battles, I got those in spades with Dauntless, which is book 1 of The Lost Fleet by Jack Campbell. It starts off with an allied Starfleet about to lose a huge battle, and its only hope is Captain John Blackjack Geary, having just been thawed from hibernation after losing his own epic battle 100 years earlier. Now, in the process of losing this battle, it's kind of like an Alamo-like stand, he holds off the opposing side, and he gains like this legendary status. His name is evoked whenever they need to lead people into battle. His final fight is, you know, the stuff of legend, and it's inspired strategies in the current 100 years later. And now he has to live kind of in his own shadow, which is an interesting place to be. Now, I can't say there's a lot of really deep characterization in this particular novel, but they had some really, really good starship battles. It satisfied that nautical / military SF itch that I get from time to time, and I gotta say the space battles were really cool. In part because he actually took into account the time it takes for light to travel in space. So think about this. You have a Starfleet spread out through a solar system. It's actually going to take minutes, if not hours, for the light from those ships to reach your ship. So if it's taking that long for it to get there, how do you maneuver your own ships? How do you react when you don't actually know where anyone is? It's a bit like submarine warfare. You know, if you read, Red Storm Rising or The Hunt for Red October, it's got a bit of that feel to it, but really it's its own beast. I enjoyed the books. like I said, not really deep, but still a lot of fun, an easy read, and I think it was a pretty small book. It was like 300 pages or something like that, so it was easy enough to blow through. Now, another book that I've been reading in that vein is The Far Side of the World by Patrick O'Brien. I started listening to this book years ago, and I just finished it. This is, for those of you who don't know, the tale of Captain Jack Aubrey and the HMS Surprise. This was a movie featuring Russell Crowe a couple of years ago, and it's basically nautical historical fiction from the late 1700s and early 1800s. This particular book takes place during the War of 1812, and the HMS Surprise has been sent to hunt down the American frigate Norfolk in the Pacific. The book ended on a subdued note. I was expecting a nice, really big ship battle on par with the earlier novels, especially after having seen the movie, but the last third of the book is more about shipwrecks than ship battles. Still, I enjoyed it. It was cool to see the crew arrive at the Galapagos Islands, and it was also interesting to see kind of how the book matched up with the movie. With the movie, they kind of, you know, picked what they wanted from all of the different books in this series. I think this is like book number 8 or 9 or something like that. I don't even remember. But in any case, they kind of cherry-picked the best parts from all those different books. And it was, you know, fun to see, okay, well, how does this all fit together? And I gotta say, although the movie is not, you know, 100% loyal to the books, I think they got the spirit of it right. I mean, the plot may be different, but the feeling of the books is definitely reflected in the movies. After I finished this book, I read The Reverse of the Medal, which is the immediate sequel to The Far Side of the World, and I liked it because it resolved a whole bunch of storylines that have been kind of outstanding in the Aubrey series, but at the same time, and this may be somewhat shallow of me, there weren't really any ship battles in the entire book. You're teased that there would be some. There's this one scene where the Surprise is starting to hunt down a, I think it's a French privateer, but they never actually make contact, and there's no battle, and the rest of it is just, you know, story development, which, I mean, it's good, the stuff that needed to be resolved, but, you know, I really would have enjoyed a nice big battle at the beginning, and then, okay, yes, let's go deal with all of Aubrey's legal proceedings. But in any case, if you're a fan of the series, this is just one of those books that you needed to read so you can continue getting through the story, but it really didn't wow me. Now, the book that I'm presently reading is The Space Opera Renaissance. I just started it, and my initial impression is it's not quite what I was hoping for. This is more of a comprehensive history of space opera than it is the space opera Renaissance. So the hard SF Renaissance was really about the stories that kind of got hard science fiction back on the map in the 90s. The space opera Renaissance, not so much. It starts off with stories from like the 1920s. I think the one I'm reading right now is from 1925. It's cool from a historical perspective to see where we came from. But I think I would have rather have had this book focus on the stuff since like 1980, the newer space opera. But in any case, I'm going to keep reading through it. I think it's a pretty good audit of space opera history. It may not be quite what I was hoping for, but we'll see how it goes. I don't know how much of the historical stuff there's going to be in there, and I don't know when the stuff from the 90s and the 2000s is actually going to kick in, but I'm going to stick with it. The cool thing about it is it's short stories, right? So if you don't like the one you're reading, well, don't worry about it. It'll be over soon enough.
Hey, this is Fred Hicks from Evil Hat. Looking for RPG podcasts? You got them at rpgpodcast.com.
And that's it for this edition of Nuketown Radioactive. You can send me comments, feedback, heretical complaints, really anything you want. You can send it to me at nuketown@gmail.com. You can follow my exploits online at Twitter at www.twitter.com/nukehavoc. And finally, don't forget to stop by the website at www.nuketown.com and leave some comments on the show notes for this particular episode.